Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us this morning students from Viroqua High School. Would those students please stand? Good. Thank you for coming. Please be seated. These students are with us with a program that is sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin. It is a national award-winning program. High school students from across the state are invited to come to oral argument. They are supplied briefs by the court before oral argument, and their instructors discuss the case we're about to hear with them and may present additional materials. In addition to the preparation before coming here and to the oral argument, the students will meet with a justice of the court during the noon hour, and everyone is invited to attend that session. It is on the procedures used by the court, not the substance of the case we are about to hear. So let me start on my far right, introducing the court to you. There's Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Seated to my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox. And to his left is Justice Crooks. And you will meet this noon with Justice Crooks. And on the far left is Justice Diane Sykes. With these introductions made, I will call our first case for today, our second for the May sitting, and it is 02-0153 CR State v. Joseph F. Giles. Representing the defendant, appellant petitioner Joseph F. Giles, is Mark S. Rosen. You have 25 minutes and 5 for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Mark Rosen. I'm here on behalf of defendant appellant petitioner Joseph Giles. Bottom line to this case is that should this Court affirm the Court of Appeals, it will unequivocally state that police officers never lie at Fifth Amendment suppression hearings, and frankly, given the extent of what Judge Crawford's ruling was, would probably state that police officers never lie at Fourth Amendment suppression hearings, and we could take this ad nauseum to the level where you could say they never lie at trial. And that is not the law, and that is not the law as handed down by the Supreme Court of the United States as well as the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. As the Court may recall from my briefs, Jackson v. Deno was the first case cited in which the U.S. Supreme Court unequivocally stated that you have to have these sort of Miranda Goodchild motion hearings outside of the presence of the jury prior to any testimony before the confession can be admitted if there is an issue with respect to voluntariness. This was prior to Miranda. But then the most interesting thing about that case, Jackson versus Dano, was that it refers to, at 84 Supreme Court 1789, to Townsend versus Sane, which was a habeas corpus case, a federal habeas corpus case, in which the Supreme Court acknowledged that prior to doing these sorts of federal habeas corpuses on state court reviews, there has to be a full and fair evidentiary hearing. And as Jackson Townsend versus Sane stated, the requirement, you have to have a full and fair evidentiary hearing because, as it states at 83 Supreme Court 762, where unresolved factual dispute exists, one must look at demeanor evidence as a significant factor in judging credibility. And questions of credibility, of course, are basic to resolution of conflicts in testimony.
Counsel, I want to get a preliminary question that I had out of the way, if you can answer it. The issue here is, of course, in the case in chief. The state has the burden of proving this here. And so the question is whether or not the state can put this document in without having the police call it. Now, does that, if we were to say that that's okay, that the Court of Appeals was correct, would that ipso facto mean that a defendant could not call that same police officer to impeach him?
Well, except for the fact that the state has the burden of proving his case at both ends, as the court has admitted, the state, the defendant, I'm sure, could call that witness to the stand to impeach him. But I think that in order to get past that stage, in order to resolve whether or not there were both aspects of the Miranda Goodchild motion were met and the burden of proof was met, the state must first present the live evidence, because of the simple fact is, as indicated throughout case law and as the court is well aware, cross-examination is one very clear avenue and one very clear tool for finding out what is the truth in terms of what happens. As I think I indicated in my reply brief.
For instance, if you as the defense attorney had reason to believe that the officer was intoxicated at the time he was interrogating the suspect, or that he was using force on the defendant, there would be nothing in the rulings below that would prohibit you from calling that police officer and questioning him about that, is there?
I don't see that there would be, except for the fact that, given the fact that it's our position that the rules of evidence, as indicated in the promulgation rules of the Supreme Court, do not prohibit, exempt that portion of the rules that say that the rules of evidence don't apply to these sorts of hearings. But there is, would be really probably nothing to prohibit that, except for the fact that the state has to make the burden of proof and make.
I'm aware of that.
And that's what our position is.
But if the position, if I understand your answer, I think your answer is yes. The defendant can call the police officer to impeach. Then it strikes me that one could argue that your position is simply asking the court to allow a fishing expedition and cross-examination of a police officer. Because if you're allowed to get the evidence in by calling him directly, of which you have actual knowledge, then it seems to me that all cross-examination does is allow you to engage in a fishing expedition against this officer.
Well, except for the fact that, as every attorney must do, you have an ethical obligation to present a good faith motion. We cannot just present fishing expedition motions. We have to present a motion that
I'm talking about cross-examination. If you, as the defense counsel, have no information that the officer was drunk, that he was on drugs, that he used force, that he's lying, then all you really need to do, what you're trying to accomplish, it seems to me, is get that officer on the stand so that you can engage in a fishing expedition.
Except for the fact that before we present these motions, I think every ethical defense counsel is going to speak to his client and find out what his client's position is, so we know what the issues are and what the narrow issues are. So it's not that we don't have a basis to believe that the police officer is intoxicated, or that we don't know that he engaged in unlawful practices or coercive practices, but we have an idea of what happened, and we have an idea from our client, because the basis of any of these Miranda Goodchild motion hearings is based upon what our client has told us in terms of how these are conducted, because clearly they're not videotaped. We weren't there. We have no idea except for the word of our client, who says, they did this, they did this, they did this.
Well, why didn't you go see the police officer before the suppression hearing and ask him?
I wasn't the attorney.
No, but I mean, if you were, would you? Would he talk to you?
I don't know. I've talked to police officers prior to when I'm looking at evidence in the evidence locker and I ask them a question, and they generally tell me that this is not the trial and we're not going to talk about this. So basically, I've not done that. I've basically, whenever we do these motion hearings, the state presents the evidence, which is the live witness, and then we cross-examine them.
Let me tell you what my problem is with the case. I think you've got a very interesting legal question that you're trying to present. The question is whether you can do it in the posture of this case, as I see it, and as I understand the state's brief, and I recognize I may not understand the state's brief. You are not here on direct appeal.
I went through the Court of Appeals and up to the Supreme Court.
Well, what I mean by that, you're not here on direct appeal from the conviction.
No.
You made a motion was made about a year after the conviction, if I remember the facts. Is that right?
That's
correct. It's close enough.
Yes.
Ineffective assistance counsel.
Correct.
So you are in an ineffective assistance of counsel mode.
Well, I took both modes. I took an ineffective assistance of counsel mode because Daryl Cassis and the trial counsel did not object to the proceedings as Judge Crawford was going to lay out. But there's no guarantee. But I also took the mode at the end of my brief without reciting all my legal arguments, because I just basically, it was the same legal arguments, that the state had not met its burden of proof at that point. And I did both avenues just to protect myself.
But you still have to get that under an effective assistance of counsel.
Well, if the court, there's no guarantee that Judge Crawford, had Judge Daryl Cassis has presented the argument and objected, that Judge Crawford would have said, all right, in that case, I'm going to make the state prove the witness. That's why I went both routes, because I didn't know, I didn't want to preclude anything.
All right. You are a careful lawyer.
Pardon me?
You are a careful lawyer.
I like to think so, yes.
Okay. So, but now that I've said that and raised that as an issue, and then the state can say how that mode does or doesn't affect your argument, I thought I would start where Justice Babbage did and just go through the proceedings and let's see where the error is or is not, okay?
Fine.
So we have a suppression hearing, right?
That's correct.
Right. And I'm looking at page 3 of your brief. And then you say the state has the burden of proof. I don't think anybody is debating that.
No.
Okay. That the confession was voluntary, et cetera. And it says in your brief, after the submission of this report, the trial court found that the state had met its required burden of proof, right? Did you make, this is on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 lines, 9 and 10 lines.
I see it, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, did you make a motion at that time to suppress because the state hadn't met its burden? You weren't the trial counsel, but trial counsel.
I didn't make that. No, what happened is that at that point in time, as indicated in the transcripts, Judge Crawford turned to defense counsel, Daryl Cassin, and said, do you have any evidence? And at that point in time, Daryl Cassin said, we're presenting Mr. Giles. So he did not make a motion. What Daryl Cassin did was at the conclusion of the hearing, after all testimony was taken, he said, this hasn't met the burden of proof because all we have is pieces of paper.
But before you put on testimony, which was the defendant's own testimony, did the trial court find that it was good enough, the police report was good enough? Because that's what that says.
Right. My recollection from the transcript is that he said, at page 11 of the transcript, it says, the Joseph Giles police report dealing with the interrogation by police of Joseph Giles meets the state's burden of production on the question of whether Mr. Giles received Miranda warnings and waived those warnings knowingly and voluntarily prior to being interrogated. The report also meets the state's burden of production and demonstrated that the statements that were made were knowing and voluntary. I reached these preliminary conclusions based on information, page 1. So, Mr. K, after he makes this another paragraph, preliminary findings, then he says, Mr. Cassis,
right. Okay, so he made a fight. He held you were going to lose unless you did something.
I believe so, yes.
Enough. Okay, so yeah, the error, if I understand your case, the error here that you're complaining about is that the trial court could not hold that a police report without an officer there, a police report was good enough in a suppression hearing to substantiate the state's burden of proof.
That is
your position?
Yeah, it is our position.
That is your position. So the error happened right there at page 3, line 9.
Correct. And also before, because at that point in time, Judge Crawford basically allowed the police report into evidence without any authentication, which is another matter we're presenting. These are not self-authenticating documents. So the whole procedure prior to that was erroneous.
So, to get back to Justice Babbage's question, Your position is, if I understand it, you didn't have to present any evidence at that moment. After the police report went down, you could be absolutely silent because the state had the burden of proof, and your position is the state didn't meet it.
Yes. Derek Hassison could have remained silent, which is Goodchild says that
Except that here the trial court made a finding against you, so you had to do something.
That's what I presume Mr. Hassison was thinking.
But you're asking then, in other words, the position you're taking is that without testimony, live testimony, an officer's report could never be taken by the court as meeting the burden of proof at that point. Is that, in other words, your position is a bright line that Judge Crawford at that point made an erroneous ruling because he looked at the report and he decided without any other examination that this was sufficient.
That's correct. It was I'm not going to get an issue as to whether or not a certified police report would have met the requirements because we don't have that. What we just have is the three police pieces of paper that basically Mr. Hassison attached to his motion, which the state didn't even produce, which was designed basically to get the ball rolling in the first place.
What would a certified report done? Say that this is the report of Officer, whatever his name was, Mary Smith?
I don't know because I don't have that in front of me. I haven't really got into what would have happened if that had happened because that's
not
before court.
But that's what a certification would have been, a certified copy.
Would right.
Just if that, said this is a true and accurate copy of the police report or is the original police report as filed in the Department of Police?
That may or may not have done it.
But that's what it would have been, right?
I imagine so.
So can I just... The issue then is that there must be testimony from the officer at all times. There never could be, what I think your position is, there never can be a police report that the judge can look at and based solely on that, make that ruling.
That's correct. I think that would be analogous to simply presenting these motion hearings by term of affidavit. And I think there's been case law, basically, that talks about that I presented to the court the federal case law, Matlock and Raddatz, I think it was, that basically said that affidavits are not sufficient at these sorts of hearings, that you have to have somebody so you can, and Burnett talks about this with the Supreme Court, and Owens talks about this, and I think Goodchild talks about this, that the trier of fact has to be able to look at the person, a judge demeanor, look at the person in the eye, test credibility through cross-examination,
okay, so
that sort of thing.
Assuming that, and that's what, and basically I'm looking at the State versus Owens, which is 148 Wisconsin 922. So based on that, then where do we go? Do you want us to send this back? What do we do with this?
Well, my position is, and I thought long and hard about what I did, because I did take the ineffective assistance of counsel as well as the burden of proof issue, is that it's our position that if Mr. Becker comes here and says it was done properly, as it is right now, he is precluded from saying, well, if you're going to say it was drawn wrong, now let's send it back. I'm sorry. So basically, I think that we are at a position now where we either take two steps. First step, which I'm asking, is that this court says the state did not meet its burden of proof. Mr. Simpson at the trial level never said we want to present the police officer. The state has not met its burden of proof. This court reversed the decision and basically threw out that suppression hearing. That's that Judge Crawford's decision. Throw out that statement and let Mr. Giles decide what he wants to do if he wishes to withdraw his plea, because we have to go back. This motion hearing was done before he took his plea. Or the court can say we're going to let him withdraw his plea and start off, and if he wants to have a Miranda Goodchild motion hearing, he can, and just take it from there and see where we go and just start over again. I would prefer that the court say clearly that the state has not met its burden of proof and go that route.
Counsel, what's the difference between meeting a burden of production and burden of proof?
I don't know. I think the way the transcript reads is that Judge Crawford, Judge Crawford was talking about burden of proof, because burden of production meaning basically the state has produced enough evidence to meet the burden of proof, because Judge Crawford did recite the burden pursuant to Armstrong earlier, and then state that the state now has met its burden of production to go forward and rest on the motion.
In other contexts, for instance, a person, let's say a state or a party can have a burden of production, oftentimes referred to as a burden of going forward, to establish a prima facie case. Now, I'm talking about in other contexts, not necessarily here. But if you have the burden of production to establish, to go forward and set forth the prima facie case is not tantamount to meeting your burden of proof. And so burden of production is establishing, in some contexts, establishing a prima facie case is not the same as saying you have established your burden of proof. Now, here the burden of proof is a preponderance of evidence. Isn't that right? By the greater weight of the credible evidence, I think, in terms of Miranda Goodchild. Voluntariness, for instance, I think is preponderance of evidence. So I'm not sure if a court making a finding that the state has met its burden of production is tantamount to a finding that a court has met its burden of proof. Let me ask a threshold question. Before the defendant is called to testify, does the court have to make a finding that the state has produced evidence that shows by a preponderance of the evidence that the statement was voluntary? I mean, is that the state's burden of proof that must be met before there's the second part of the hearing, that is, any defense testimony?
No, I think that what these usually happen is that the court makes its final findings and decision after all the testimony is taken. The problem that I think is that arises is that in this case, Mr. Cassinson was essentially forced to put on his client in a situation where it's totally arbitrary. He didn't have to do that, because Judge Crawford said at this point in time, from what I read here, is the state's done, it's met its burden of proof, we're allowing the state to rest. Mr. Cassinson, go.
My problem, and I just don't have the transcript in front of me, or have I read it, the part that you're referring to. My problem is, as you read it, and I think you made reference to, page 11, what the trial court found was a burden of production. Am I wrong? And is there language around what you read that would indicate that really what the court was doing was saying the state had met its burden of proof?
No, the word production is accurate. But the thing is that Judge Crawford at this time says, Mr. Cassinson, at this point in time, after he's made his preliminary conclusions, that the state has met its burden of production, quote, unquote, with respect to both Miranda and Goodchild, he then says, Mr. Cassinson, now what do you want to do? And if Mr. Cassinson could have simply said, we're not putting on any evidence, and at that point in time, based upon what we've got here with respect to what he said, I think it's crystal clear that Judge Crawford would have said, fine, it's done. The state has met its burden of proof with respect to both Miranda and Goodchild because of what he said about the burden of production, and therefore been done with it. And I think that's a clear reading, because at this point in time he allowed the state to rest. He allowed the state, forced the state to rest without putting in any live witnesses.
I'm not entirely clear. When the suppression hearing began, what did the state say at that point?
The state basically didn't say anything. From what I recall of the transcript, the state basically, Judge Crawford took it over and said, here are the three pieces of paper attached to Mr. Giles's motion, and that's where we're going. I'm out of time. I'm going to.
You have red lights on you.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
We're there, sir.
Thank you.
May I ask you, was there a preliminary examination in this case?
I cannot recall. I cannot recall because I've been focusing on what happened with the Miranda Goodchild.
I thought I read in your brief a reference to a preliminary examination, and I'm what? No?
It was waived.
Thank you.
It was waived.
It was
waived.
Thank you, Justice.
Of course, it wouldn't have, if you had the evidence there, that would raise different issues.
Correct. And as far as preliminary examinations go, in Milwaukee County, it's my experience that the state would have simply put on the statement, had the police officer testify, as Mr. Giles said, and they would not have allowed any Miranda Goodchild issues because that's not relevant at a preliminary hearing. I don't even think the victim would have testified at that sort of a hearing. And I don't believe it would have been necessary for a simple finding of probable cause, especially under State versus Dunn.
Counsel, if I may go back for just one moment where I started. You started off with a bang, and it was a good opening about cops never lie if we uphold the courts of appeal. But I'd answer that by saying if they are lying and if you have reason to believe that they are, there's nothing to stop you from calling that officer as your own witness or to impeach him as an adverse witness at the Goodchild hearing.
Because the fact...
What's the harm?
Well, the harm is none except for the fact that we have to get to the stage where the defendant has to present witness, and a defendant does not have to present any witnesses or any evidence pursuant to Goodchild. The state has the motion of producing all of this and producing it and going forward and meeting a burden of proof.
I'm asking what the harm is here. Let's say that we say that the production of these police reports is as sufficient to satisfy the state's burden of proof. How are you harmed if you are able to call the police to impeach them?
We're not harmed. I'm just asking the court not to get to that level because I don't think that that's sufficient for the state to meet its burden of proof pursuant to all of the case law that I've submitted. And that's my position.
Is there evidence in the record that the defense counsel knew that the officers would not be there?
The only evidence I can tell, and this is just circumstantial, is that Judge Crawford has been doing this practice for years. And basically anybody that's ever been in his courtroom knows kind of how this procedure works. I can't speak for what Mr. Castleson did because I wasn't there. But I think that I don't know if he did or didn't, to be perfectly honest. I imagine he probably thought Judge Crawford wasn't going to, but I don't know if he did or if he was actually expecting a police officer to testify or how that was going to happen. I don't know.
But this is a practice of Judge Crawford on a suppression. We're not talking about a preliminary, on a suppression.
It's my understanding. I've never appeared in front of Judge Crawford on a suppression motion hearing. So I can't talk about that. I've only seen one or two, and he's never done it. But I don't know if Darrell Castleson had ever seen one before or either.
It looks like the motion hearing was held on the heels of a competency hearing.
I vaguely recall it.
The case was scheduled for a competency review, and there was a stipulation to competency, and the judge just went right into the suppression hearing.
Well, I think that also Judge Crawford also used, because there was a report that said he was competent, but I think also that the report, from my recollection, said that Mr. Giles was malingering, unless I'm mistaken. And I think that came out in the suppression motion and concerning Mr. Giles' testimony. That's my recollection. It's from what happened, is that that's where we were.
It sure would speed things up if you didn't have to bring in the police officer, and it sure would cut Milwaukee County costs if you didn't have to bring in a police officer and kept the officer in the patrol car or on the beat.
Well, we could do jury trials by police reports, and I don't mean to be flip or anything like that, but you could take that level to anything else, and I think the case law that's presented to this court, Jackson versus the whole body of case law that's presented from Jackson versus Deno, Townsend versus Sane, the whole U.S. Supreme Court, the whole Wisconsin Supreme Court case law, everything about that talks about demeanor, credibility, looking the person in the eye, assessing his tone of voice, and that's even the Raddatz even talks about that, where the magistrate basically was able to judge demeanor, able to look at people in the eye and decide who to believe and not to believe.
But isn't there a different level of evidence required at trial than there is at the suppression hearing? In other words, the state makes that point that we're not talking about the normal rules of evidence at this level. So that's the difference between the trial and this particular motion hearing.
That's correct, except for the fact that, as indicated in the Supreme Court rules, the rules of evidence The rule exempting rules of evidence at these sorts of hearings does not apply to habeas corpus proceedings, which is what Townsend was. And it's true that they could have done that, but there's a whole body of case law out there that says that you have to be able to look the person in the eye and judge demeanor. With all due respect to the court, I believe I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rosen. Assistant Attorney General David Becker, representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Becker.
May it please the Court, as you just indicated, I'm Assistant Attorney General David Becker. I appear here on behalf of the State of Wisconsin, the plaintiff respondent in this case. Where I think I'd like to start here is with something that Justice Abramson brought up, and I don't want the Court to lose sight of it, and that is primarily, if not exclusively, this case is in the posture before this Court of an appeal from the denial of a post-conviction motion challenging the effective assistance of counsel in relation to the suppression hearing. And when we are talking about ineffective assistance of counsel, we all know it's the law is well settled and it's repeated in scores of cases. There's a two-pronged burden to meet. The first burden is to show that there was deficient performance. The second burden is to show, and these are the burdens on the defendant to meet in order to successfully make out a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. He has to show deficient performance and he has to show prejudice. The argument that has been made in opposing counsel's brief and the entire focus of the argument this morning by opposing counsel and the questions from the Court have all dealt basically with things that go to the question of deficient performance because they have dealt with whether or not the suppression hearing was properly conducted and if it wasn't, shouldn't trial counsel have made the appropriate objections, and it is in that that the claim of ineffectiveness lies, that counsel failed to properly object when the suppression hearing was not conducted appropriately, at least insofar as opposing counsel is concerned. Of course, the State's position is that the suppression hearing was conducted appropriately. But I don't want this Court to lose sight of the fact that there is that second prong. And I'm not going to dwell on it at length here this morning because I think the first prong is obviously the meaty legal issue that probably got this case before this Court. But in disposing of this case, you've got to also focus on the prejudice prong. And on that prong, there can be no question but that the defendant has woefully failed to satisfy his burden. And I should add, this is not even really a case directly involving the question of the ultimate question of ineffectiveness of counsel. It's a case involving the question of whether or not, in response to the defendant's motion raising ineffectiveness of counsel, the trial court should have granted a Mockner hearing. So what we're really concerned with respect to both of the prongs, is whether or not there were sufficient allegations in the post-conviction motion to give rise to issues with respect to deficient performance and prejudice that the Court had to hold a hearing on. And that is where, at least with regard to prejudice, the defendant's case is completely lacking, and for that reason, if for no other, his request for a Mockner hearing was properly denied. He did not make any allegations in that post-conviction motion that went to the question of prejudice. And in this kind of a situation that we've got here, I think there are two perspectives from which we can view the question of prejudice. One of them is clearly addressed in Wisconsin case law, and that is from the perspective of a case in which there has been a guilty plea. And this Court said in Bentley that when a defendant is raising ineffective assistance of counsel in the context of such a case where there has been a guilty plea, it is incumbent upon the defendant to allege in his post-conviction motion, if he wants that Mockner hearing, if he wants that hearing on the question of ineffective assistance of counsel, it is incumbent upon him to allege that had his counsel performed properly, he would not have pled guilty. But and under Bentley, even that's an absolute necessity, but that is not in itself sufficient because the defendant had made such an allegation, and the Court went on to hold that even that, though, wasn't enough. It's necessary, but not sufficient. And it's necessary that you support that allegation with factual allegations.
Mr. Becker, that may be a perfectly sound legal argument, but it sounds awfully technical to me. I mean, if a defense counsel, if the motion raised is ineffective assistance of counsel, it seems to me that couldn't this court simply say that it's implied that there's prejudice, that they're alleging prejudice? Why raise the motion of ineffective assistance of counsel if he's not impliedly raising the question of prejudice?
The case law is absolutely contrary to that position. Prejudice is an absolutely critical component, and except in a few rare instances, there will not be an implication of prejudice from a situation. You've narrowly delineated certain situations. This is not one of them. When a defendant pleads guilty to establish prejudice, he has to make the allegation that he wouldn't have pled guilty but for the deficient performance, and what is so critical under Bentley is he has to support that. Here we don't even have the allegation. That's not a technical – I'm not throwing a technical roadblock in his path. That's an absolutely critical component of making out a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Also, can I just ask, is there some way – and I know that you're probably the wrong person to ask – but if this Court just said we want to sidestep the ineffective assistance of counsel and get to the what we may or may not think is the heart of this, is should there be, quote, live testimony in a suppression hearing? In other words, that's the –
Yeah, but I don't think you can sidestep it if you want to use this case as the vehicle to create law with respect to that question. I don't think you can sidestep it with respect to the ultimate relief you grant in this case. You can, by the way in which you tackle these issues, you can get to that issue, but ultimately you're going to have to confront the question of prejudice is this man entitled to any relief? Because even if you say we'd like to have the live testimony, and there should have been live testimony here, and I'm ready to argue that that wasn't necessary, and I will be getting to that in a moment, the fact of the matter is that the attorney did not object. In this case, in this Court's decisions are replete with the and I cited them both at the beginning of my brief and at the end of my brief. The Cassitolo decision and a number of other decisions of the Wisconsin appellate courts have clearly indicated that when a defendant doesn't object, then testimony that might otherwise – hearsay testimony, and that's what we're talking about here, that evidence which might not otherwise be admissible to prove facts becomes admissible. It is still competent evidence to prove facts. So in the absence of an objection, even if you say live testimony is the rule, that rule didn't obtain here because the defendant didn't make the objection to the lack of the live testimony, and therefore the hearsay evidence under those cases that I cite both at the beginning of my brief and at the end of my brief become the hearsay here becomes competent evidence upon which the trial court could properly rely.
But isn't that the ineffective assistance?
And that's the ineffective, right? And that so we ultimately return back to ineffective assistance of counsel. And when we're and with respect to ineffective assistance of counsel, we have that prejudice prong that the defendant has not met. So the defendant cannot succeed on this appeal, whatever you decide with respect to that issue.
I expected you to say on prejudice he made a guilty plea and everything else has been waived. There's a procedure in the statute book that says if evidence wasn't suppressed and you want to make a conditional guilty plea, namely a guilty plea only if state's affirmed on appeal, you can do that, right?
Yeah. Well,
they didn't do it here, did they?
No. No. Well, now I'm not sure I understand you. You don't have to enter a conditional guilty plea. You have by statute that right to don't quite understand this, but you have that statutory right to bring up the rulings on suppression motions,
right,
even though you have pled guilty. The guilty plea waiver rule is by statute abrogated when we're talking about suppression issues.
And do you have to then bring it by direct appeal from the conviction under that rule?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So what you have here is a guilty plea without
right.
a direct appeal, and that's your position.
Yeah, except I'm not so sure there's not a direct appeal from the conviction. I mean, the notice of appeal is, I think, from both the conviction and the order.
Then why are we – why do you present this as a case, an appeal on effective assistance of counsel?
Because that's
not a direct
– Well, I argued it both ways, and I've argued it in my brief, and I've argued it both ways this morning, where I have suggested the primary thrust has been the post-conviction motion was ineffective assistance of counsel. If you're looking at it as a direct attack on the result of the suppression motion, then what I just said is my response, and that is – with no objection from opposing counsel to how the trial court handled this thing, and in particular, no objection to that police report and that reliance on that police report because it was hearsay, and no objection based on the fact on an allegation that you can't rely on that, you need live testimony, then under this Court's decisions, that hearsay that might otherwise have been objectionable, and in the defense view, it would be objectionable. We dispute that because we don't think the rules of evidence apply.
Okay, let's get to the main event.
Okay, yes.
Now, I noticed in your brief on, one of your footnotes talks about confrontation, right?
Right, and that's the Frams case. There's absolutely no right to confrontation at a pretrial motion on the admissibility of evidence. So, I don't find opposing counsel making any contention to the contrary with respect to that. He's relied purely on due process as the basis for his claim.
Which includes confrontation.
It may or may not include confrontation. It does not include the constitutional right to confrontation that is guaranteed at trial, obviously. Due process does not always require confrontation.
Well, let me ask you this, okay? What's the State's position on a State just solely producing a police report?
Chief, I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. What is the State's position about the State's producing only a police report at a suppression hearing? It raises the question of voluntary, knowing, et cetera, statement or Miranda statement. And a motion is then made by the defendant that the evidence should be suppressed because the State has not carried its burden of persuasion.
Our position is that I don't think a district attorney would probably ever on his own rely purely on a police report as his presentation of his case on a suppression motion. I think in the absence of a judge who, as this judge did, conducted a suppression hearing, which I think is defensible, but a judge who conducted a suppression hearing and I don't know how I want to put this. All I can say is no district attorney affirmatively, I think, would have tried to do what went on here in terms of relying.
That's not the question, number one. Yeah. And number two, doesn't the State have the obligation to tell the court if the court isn't making an error and say to the court, Judge, I want to put on testimony because I think otherwise have a problem.
Right. Okay. But here's the thing. We don't have – if the judge is ready to – and let me use the words of – Matlock is one of our – one of the primary cases we rely on, which indicates that you
– No, so I can understand you and hear you. Tell me yes or no.
Okay.
Question is, what the good DA is going to do or what a good judge is going to do.
Right.
I want to know if you have a pure form case where the only thing put on is a police report on a suppression motion. Can it withstand a motion by the defense to dismiss for failure of the State to carry its burden of persuasion? Answer me yes.
Carry its burden of what?
Persuasion.
Can it withstand
motion
a motion?
Dismiss.
And the answer is yes.
It can. So it's good enough.
It's good enough.
We don't recommend it.
We do not recommend it. It is only barely good enough, and it is running a terrific risk because most judges won't find it sufficient.
Wow.
Most judges won't find it sufficient.
Well,
I don't think.
After the Court of Appeals decision, and if you succeed in us affirming the Court of Appeals decision, isn't everybody going to do it, or at least 99% of them? Unless the defense attorney objects.
That's why my initial reaction when you took this case was, I wish they had let sleeping dogs lie.
Sleeping dog is a precarious.
Well, I think this. I would love to see you simply say he didn't meet the burden on prejudice with respect to ineffectiveness of counsel, and insofar as there's a direct attack on the outcome, there was no objection made. And therefore, in the absence of an objection, the Court could properly consider it, and that's our decision. That's what I would love to see, because I don't think I want the message sent that this is to become the model in Wisconsin. And like I say, I don't think for prosecutors it would be, because they're running too great a risk that the trial court isn't going to credit the report.
Justice Abrams. You may not want this to be a model, but then why do you object, and as I hear it, to the model being you got to bring in more than, and it may not be the police officer, it may be something else, more than a police report. Why would you, I hear you objecting and you're saying police report is okay. Is that what you want this court to say?
Well, if you're going to confront that issue, that's what the law says. Because if it's not okay, it's got to be not okay for one of two reasons. One is because it violates the rules of evidence, and the other is because it somehow violates due process. Now, with respect to the rules of evidence, I don't really see my opponent making a strong argument or really an argument at all. Throughout his brief, he basically concedes that this is not a question of the rules of evidence, and he doesn't make a strong argument that if any at all, that the rules of evidence were violated here. He puts all his eggs pretty much in the single basket of due process. And with respect to due process, that takes me back to the Matlock decision, which affirmatively indicates, doesn't speak in terms of due process, but clearly sanctions the notion that we don't need to apply the rules of evidence, and in particular the hearsay rule, which would then require live testimony, in the context of a suppression hearing. Now, concededly, Matlock was a Fourth Amendment suppression hearing. This is a Fifth Amendment suppression hearing. I can't find any reason why we would distinguish the two.
Let's say you're right, that the rules of evidence do not apply. And so we have a record before us that's admissible, and it is that report. Does that record, as a matter of law, meet the state's burden of persuasiveness at a suppression hearing?
And are you talking now about the entire record or just the record up to the point where the judge had said you've met your burden of production by producing that report?
Where the court made that statement, you've met your burden of whatever your burden
yes.
was.
Yes. And clearly said, you picked up on, clearly said burden of production, not burden of proof. And there's a difference between burden of production and burden of proof. And I think this ties into the question that I think you just asked, which is,
as a matter of law, was the trial court wrong? Let me back up.
Yeah.
If you interpret the trial court saying he met his burden of production, is a burden of production sufficient at that stage to require the defense to go forward? Or does state have to meet its burden of persuasion?
I'm not so sure if Wisconsin case law spells this out very well, but I would think that if the state has met its burden of production, then what we have is really a judge's determination, not that he has met his burden of proof. I think you were absolutely on the right track when you suggested it in other contexts, and I think it's true in this context as well, that meeting a burden of production is not necessarily meeting a burden of proof. Meeting a burden of production means you've produced sufficient evidence that if I decide to credit it, and if I find it persuasive enough, that you've then met your burden of proof, but that the question of proof could still go either way because I may or I could without I could, in the exercise of my fact-finding power, find this sufficient. I don't have to find it sufficient.
So if on this record, on this statement, the defense said, Judge, we're not going to offer any testimony. Am I correct in saying, as a matter of law, the state would have failed to meet its burden of persuasion at this suppression hearing?
I don't think so. By the same token, I don't think as a matter of law it met its burden of persuasion.
Well,
I'm sorry, Justice Sykes.
As a matter of fact here, the state didn't produce anything.
Well, that's true.
About burden of production, yeah. Burden of persuasion begs the question. The state didn't come forward with any evidence here at all.
Well, except that the trial court treated the stuff it grabbed from the
motion
that was attached
as
yeah,
burden.
Yeah.
How can that be? Is that allowed?
I'm sorry, was last
question. Is that permissible?
Well, I don't. I find it hard to find it impermissible if that's how the court wants to deal with it.
As a technical matter, we had no evidence offered by the state here at all.
Well, boy,
they took it as evidence.
That's true. I mean, I think implicitly it was this, you know, the state didn't make any complaint about the judge relying on that.
And did the state argue this motion?
Sure.
And
on the basis of the police report.
Did they then rely on the police report?
Sure.
So they adopted what the trial court did.
Yeah, I don't think that's an issue in this case.
It's not really very well done, obviously. I mean,
And that's why I said we're not. Well, I mean, I haven't said it yet, but we're not. And somebody has said it. Somebody said it here. If it wasn't me, that this is not going to be propounded as a model for how to handle suppression hearings.
The problem with the difference between being propounded as a model. And no one's going to suggest that, and be propounded as an acceptable standard is what causes you to be nervous, too, and I would imagine wanted sleeping dogs lie, because if we address this meaty issue and say this is okay, then, of course, what's the lowest common denominator oftentimes becomes the standard practice.
Right. And
you don't want that.
And I don't want that, and I don't think, and I think even if you said
why don't you want that?
Because I think the reason I said before is I don't think that really benefits anyone, because while one of the justices, I think it was Abramson, indicated that, well, maybe this is a way to help with caseload and we can make suppression hearings a lot more efficient, I still come back to what I said earlier. I don't think, even if you sanctioned this as permissible, I don't think any district attorney would when asked to present his case, would say, well, Judge, in light of the Giles decision, here are the police reports, and I rest. I think a district attorney would have to be a fool because of what I said earlier. While the police reports can, if the judge wants to credit them, be sufficient, I think the DA would be running a significant risk that most judges would say, no, before I find you've met your burden by preponderance of the evidence, I would like to hear some sworn testimony. That's what's going to convince me. I'm not going to be convinced by sheets of paper. Not that I can't be. They've told us in Giles that I can be, but I'm not going to be.
Let's just talk about the law for a moment.
Okay.
Do you concede or do you agree that due process demands that a criminal defendant is entitled to a full and fair evidentiary hearing on the motion to suppress?
We have absolutely no disagreement with that.
Okay. The disagreement is what constitutes a full and fair evidentiary hearing.
Absolutely.
Okay. And we also agree that you can use hearsay at the suppression hearing.
I don't know that my opponent agrees. You and I agree, Mayor Press.
All right.
I agree. I agree.
All right. But Matlock, upon which you rely, that didn't rely solely on hearsay. There was, the declarant was there and subject to cross-examination.
Well, and as Justice Babbage said here, I don't see any reason why the declarant here couldn't have been subject to cross-examination if the defendant had wanted to call.
The reason, Mr. Becker, is because you are putting the burden, when you say that, on the defendant. And that you are saying that the state, in its part of the suppression motion, merely has to put on a prima facie case. And that's the whole point that Justice Bradley, I think, is making, at least as I see it. And that's why when I phrased the question to you, I put in that the defense, at the end of the state's case on suppression, moved to dismiss on the grounds of the burden of persuasion. And what you respond to me now is it was cleaned up by the defendant. And I agree with that as a general proposition. If the plaintiff who has the burden of persuasion fails to put in a good enough case and the defendant goes along his merry way and puts it in for the state, can't complain. You don't look just at the one end of the case. You look at the whole thing.
Right.
And that's your point, when you look at the whole thing. But the question that we keep asking you is, which will be the next case if it's not this one, after the state puts in its case, will it withstand a motion to dismiss?
Okay. Now, let me see if I can make clear, because maybe we haven't understood each other. First of all, motion to dismiss is kind of foreign to me in terms of terminology in the context of suppression motions.
It's the usual motion made at a trial after the State puts in its evidence.
And I think that's what it would be analogous. And that's what I understood you to be saying, an emotion analogous to that.
Right.
Okay. But an emotion analogous to that, if it isn't, does not require, to deny a motion analogous to that, a judge does not find, as a matter of law, that the evidence is sufficient. He only in order to deny that motion, he only finds that a reasonable fact finder could, confronted with the evidence before it, find guilt. Not that this jury is going to find guilt, not that he would find guilt if he were sitting.
That's a trial.
That's a trial. And so I'm saying that's what you want to analogize to. And if we want to, oh, I'm sorry, you
want to
shake
analogize,
your head no.
It seems to me you have not met your burden of persuasion. And I can put it. Justice Bradley states it differently. I put in the motion. Justice Bradley says the defense error here was just shouldn't have gone on. It should have just said, I have nothing to present. Judge, State hasn't met its burden of persuasion, and you should so rule, period. That's what the issue, the substantive issue as we see it.
Okay, and position is, at that point, if that was the posture of the case,
right.
There isn't a legal answer to the question of whether the State's evidence was sufficient or insufficient. There's not a. It is not a matter of law. It may be sufficient. It may not be sufficient. It depends on the fact finder. As I read earlier from.
The position is, it's good enough to get to the fact finder.
That's my position. It's good enough to get to the fact finder.
But isn't that really then the burden of production? In other words, you're saying that there is some probative evidence on a particular issue here, voluntariness, that's good enough.
Right.
But that's not the same. The burden of production is not the same as the burden of persuasion, which here is by a preponderance of evidence.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. And that's why I'm saying it's interesting to note that the judge was very specific when he said the burden of production has been met. Now, if the defense got something for me to consider before I decide whether the burden of proof has been met, I'll hear it, and the evidence was put on. Now, what he would have, now this judge could have, although I think it would have been a dastardly deed on the part of the judge, if he could have sandbagged the State, he could have said, okay, defendant hasn't put anything on, these police reports aren't convincing enough to me, because the State didn't meet its burden of proof as a matter of law, but it also didn't fail to meet its burden of proof as a matter of law. It had before the judge something that the judge could credit. I love the language in Matlock. It says the judge should receive the evidence and give it such weight as his judgment and experience counsel. This judge's judgment and experience counseled giving it sufficient weight to find that the State met its burden of proof, particularly after hearing. Well, you know, I guess we don't know, because as I said, the judge could have sandbagged the State and said, sorry, you're out. But I don't think he would have. I think he would have if the defendant had stood silent, probably would have found the report sufficient. And so then if that was the case, that hypothetical, that the hearing ended there with the judge's finding that the State board's burden of proof, then I think the Matlock language comes into play, which says the judge should receive the evidence and give it such weight as his judgment and experience counsel. Other judges' judgment and experience might counsel, this isn't sufficient. I want to hear some sworn testimony before I'm convinced. But he could, as this judge no doubt probably would have been, could have been convinced by this evidence. It could have gone either way at that point.
This is one of my problems. I look at our judicial bench book on the issue of voluntariness, and that's what's, of course, being explored in the Miranda Goodchild hearing that is the subject of this case. And the purpose of this hearing on voluntariness is, number one, to assure trustworthy evidence, number two, curb abusive police practices, and three, promote fundamental fairness. If the only evidence presented was this report, I just find that report, if that's the only evidence presented, totally lacking in fulfilling the purpose of the voluntariness inquiry at this kind of hearing. How does this report
underscore the purpose of curbing abusive police practices or sure trustworthiness of the evidence? I mean, after all, it's hearsay. I mean, how does this go to promoting fundamental fairness? So it just seems like the whole purpose is circumvented by this, if this is sufficient.
Well, and I think that would be the view of like I say, many judges in terms of whether or not they're going to be sufficiently satisfied, but I don't think it completely subverts it. It is a police report prepared by a police officer. The defendant has indicated what, in this particular hearing, the defendant indicated what the bases for his claim of violation of Miranda and lack of voluntariness were. The police report addressed those and said that that wasn't the case, that he had, I mean, his claim of involuntariness was that he had, was under the influence of some, you know, drugs or whatever that he had taken. The police report specifically addressed that and said that I asked him about whether he was under the influence of any drugs and whether it was affecting him, and the answer was no. So I think a reasonable judge could, most judges perhaps wouldn't, but a reasonable judge could find that they are satisfied that, in fact, what the defendant is now telling us is not true because the police report has sufficient credibility to convince the court that what's in the police report is true. And if that's the case, then those purposes have been satisfied.
Does the defendant have any right of confrontation at a suppression hearing?
Well, I don't certainly, like I say, not the constitutional right of confrontation that is guaranteed in the Constitution at trial. I think the answer has to be no in light of the fact that the rules of evidence don't apply.
No right to confrontation at suppression. Is that the State's position?
I think it has to be the State's position.
Could I ask?
Now, that doesn't mean that what? I don't want to be misunderstood.
All right.
The defendant certainly, as part of a full and fair evidentiary hearing, has the right to call witnesses. As part of doing that, he can, as Justice Babbage indicated, call the police officer and confront the police officer. I would admit to you that if a defendant were to say, Judge, as part of my case, all the State has put on, or all you've deemed the State to have put on, as in this case, with the State sitting by passively, is these police reports. I think there's some real question. These things are really questionable. I think the officer himself can call, that if I can have him testify, I can call into question those police reports. If the defendant says, I want to now call that police officer, and the judge says no, clear error. And if you want to call that a right to confrontation, I would say that kind of right to confrontation, absolutely he has the right. As part of his right to a full and fair evidentiary hearing, he has a right to present his case. As part of presenting his case, he has a right to call whomever he will, and whomever he will may include the officers whose statements are being relied on so that he can confront that officer regarding those statements. I don't have any question but that is part of his rights. And if that's the right of confrontation you're talking about, then he does have a right of confrontation.
Right to call witnesses, but right. not necessarily has a right to confront a police report that is an officer, per se.
Right. He doesn't have a right to demand that the State put the officer on. He has a right himself to put him on.
And that's what you say in note three. Yeah. A criminal defendant's right to confrontation has no application to pretrial hearings on the admissibility of evidence, citing Frams. But even Frams said that there was no error in the trial court basing its ruling in part on the hearsay testimony.
Well, I wish you luck if you try and parse out what part is permissible and what part isn't. We should come back another day and talk about that, perhaps. Thank you.
You'll be here another day.
Can I ask one more?
Justice Prosser has a question.
In a suppression hearing on Fourth Amendment search evidence, does the same rule apply that you don't have to have any confrontation?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, like I say, Matlock, which is one of the primary cases on which we rely, was in fact a Fourth Amendment case.
And so if the defendant's counsel didn't object, everything could come in by police report?
Yes. You're talking about now in the Fourth Amendment context. Yeah, absolutely. If the defendant didn't object, everything could come in by police report at the trial. Because this Court has said that as a general proposition, hearsay evidence is unobjected to hearsay evidence is competent evidence and may be relied on by the fact finder to establish the facts contained in it.
Well, even so, if they did object, if the defense did object, your position is hearsay is good evidence at suppression.
Now we're back to the suppression hearing. Even if he did object, yeah, hearsay is good evidence. Absolutely.
And it's good enough, hearsay evidence is good enough alone, or couldn't be good alone, enough evidence alone, to support the burden of persuasion.
So I think it could, and as I think was pointed out earlier, though, when we take the whole case here, including the defense testimony, we really even beef up the State's case because the defendant admitted there was no threats or promises.
An objection here, as far as the State goes, is irrelevant.
True, in terms of keeping out the police report.
Right. Okay.
Because it would be admissible because the rules of evidence don't apply.
I don't want to prolong this, but I have one other technical question. Was the police report in this case actually received into evidence, offered and received, or even just received, even though I think you concede it was never offered?
If it wasn't, that would be the highest of technicalities to say that that somehow made the proceeding invalid because, I mean, there's no question everybody was relying on it. The judge had it in front of him.
Well, he actually started out referring to the other guys.
Right. He started out referring to the co-defendants, but then he said, oh, yeah, excuse me, this is the one I'm interested in. And he had that in front of him, and that's what he relied on.
And all it was attached to the
motion to sever.
Motion. It wasn't a part of the record of the statement's motion.
It was, I'm sorry.
Part of the record of the Miranda Goodchild
motion. No.
It was attached to the
wasn't part of the, it was not part of the motion. It was attached to the severance motion. He
but
drew on it. He clearly received it. He may have not have uttered the words received into evidence, but there's no question that was what was happening here. My opposing counsel is not going
to
dispute that.
It's as if it went into the jury room, whether it had been received in evidence or not. And
pardon
the jury,
me?
It's as if it went into the jury room, whether it was received as evidence or not, and the jury was told to consider it.
I think that's true. I mean, if it wasn't received, I don't know. I don't want to answer that question because I don't know what the technicalities are at trial. I know that this was the judge. It was the fact finder. He had it in front of him. He clearly was relying on it. If he didn't say, I received this report into evidence, that is a technical question, and it's the highest of technicalities.
Did he read it?
He went through it line by line. Pointed exactly what he was relying on. He said, I find on the first page that there is this statement that he was given his Miranda warnings. After that statement, I see an X, his name is there, et cetera, et cetera. He clearly relied on it.
Well, isn't that an important technicality, though? I mean, in trial, a lot of documentary materials are referred to, but if they're not marked and received into evidence, they're not.
I might be more concerned if we were in trial, like I say, and that's why I backtracked from what Justice Abramson was leading me, because I don't know what the answer to that question is. But here,
I mean, the judge's recitation of the contents of the police report doesn't make the report evidence, does it?
Well, I say it does. I mean, I don't think he has to utter some magic words. I received this into evidence. He clearly relied on it as the sole support. He said, this I believe, this I credit, or at least I credit it to the point of finding it to meet the State's burden of the State has met the burden of production with this police report. Production is talking about the production of evidence. He was clearly saying that this was evidence that he was receiving. He may not have uttered those magic words. You couldn't interpret it any other way. And he may have uttered the magic words. I wasn't reading the record with that in mind, but I don't think he did utter those magic words, probably. May I sit down?
We're thinking about that, Mr. Becker. We're thinking about that. Mr. Rose.
Thank you. I did want to clarify something for the record that came out through Mr. Becker's presentation. First of all, and this is something Justice Abrahamson did allude to, although this was brought up from a motion for post-conviction relief and denial, at the trial court level, I only raised the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, but at the Court of Appeals, I also raised the issue that Mr. Cassis, and when he said these three pieces of paper don't meet their burden of proof, that was failure to meet a burden of proof, and I raised that directly to the Court of Appeals. So whatever this Court wants to do with the ineffective assistance of counsel, that issue of burden of proof was raised by Darrell Cassis, and at the close of the hearing, and I raised that to the Court of Appeals, and I raised that to this Court, too. So there's not just the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel before this Court. There's also both court issues that I clearly wanted to go both prongs because I didn't want to hang my hat on one, just as Mr. Becker did.
What about Mr. Becker's argument that you never alleged the second prong of ineffectiveness, that is, prejudice?
Well, I think the prejudice is in the way that this motion hearing was conducted. I think the fact of the matter is that basically we have to show that there was prejudice because we don't know what the police officer would have said. I understand the court's hearing on that. But the fact of the matter is the prejudice is in the fact that we have a right to cross-examine. We have a right, and Mr. Becker can say what he wants about cross-examination. A full and fair evidentiary hearing is indicated by Townsend versus Sane and Jackson versus Deno, is on and on, requires a judging of credibility, which is something that is totally relevant to these sorts of proceedings. And that, I think, clearly is done throughout the case law. It shows that you have to have some cross-examination. I also wanted to basically touch upon Frams. It's my position, and it's the position of the defendant, that Frams is nothing but a smokescreen before this Court. Mr. Becker wants to raise that up before this Court, that somehow Frams should be binding, but that it was not a Fifth Amendment motion hearing. That was simply a motion hearing to determine whether or not the defendant could present a defense statement in his case in chief. It had nothing to do with the whole basis for why we have to Miranda Goodchild motion hearings, which is, as I've gone through, you go Jackson versus Deno, is referring to Townsend versus State. We don't get a State versus Burnett, Goodchild, Owens, Armstrong, all of that. And that has nothing to do. Those have one aspect. They talk about Fifth Amendment motion hearings. Frams is on the other end of the spectrum and has nothing to do with that. So I just want the Court to remember that Frams has nothing to do with this case. I am not conceding that Fifth Amendment motion hearings do not have to follow the rules of evidence. The State of Wisconsin, the Supreme Court rules of promulgation of evidence clearly stated that Wisconsin Statutes 911 and 901 do not apply to habeas corpus proceedings. And it talks about habeas. That's at page R376 of, I think it's 59. But talks about that and then refers to Townsend versus Sane for the upon trial type proceedings with demeanor evidence as a significant factor. And that is basically the whole where we go with Jackson versus Deno, which refer to Townsend versus Sane. And not coincidentally, Townsend versus Sane was a Fifth Amendment motion hearing that the State Court heard. So I think that that is clearly relevant here. What constitutes a full and fair evidentiary hearing, I think, requires demeanor evidence, requires credibility evidence, and I think that calls into clear issues of cross-examination. When look at the whole thing, I think the Court in this case cannot look at the whole thing here. I think what happened in this case is because of Judge Crawford's erroneous conducting this, Mr. Giles was forced to testify. We don't know what would have happened had the police officer testified. We don't know if the cross-examination of the police officer would have negated Mr. Giles from having to testify. Maybe it would have. We don't know. But the fact of the matter is that we cannot put the cart before the horse and say that because Mr. Giles testified when he didn't have to in an erroneous situation like this, that somehow he basically hurt himself, because that's not what I think this case is about. I think what this case is about is whether or not what happened prior to then was sufficient, and I think clearly it wasn't. And I think that's why we shouldn't even have to get to the issue of that, because of the fact that Mr. Giles didn't have to testify, and we don't know what would have happened on cross-examination. And I think that's putting, as I indicated, putting the cart before the horse. Police reports are always questionable. That's why we have these hearings. I think that if people were conceding police reports, then we wouldn't have to have these hearings. As we all know, an ethical lawyer must always have a good faith basis for presenting these, and that always means that the police reports are in question. So I don't think that anybody's going to say that the police reports are never questionable, or because they always are at these sorts of hearings. That's all I have. And also, with respect to the suppression motion, you said, I looked through the record. I did not see that the three pages of the police reports were ever marked as an exhibit at the motion hearing.
What are you asking for, again, as a remedy? You want the status quo before the child hearing?
Well, I want either this court to find that the State has not met its burden of proof at the motion hearing, and to throw out the Miranda Goodchild motion hearing and take it from there, or if that is my first step, to say that the State did not meet its burden of proof, or to say that we want to take it back before the Miranda Goodchild motion hearing and allow him to withdraw his plea and take it from there, whichever the court wishes. So I think that's the only remedy.
I don't understand the difference between the two.
Well, if the court...
One throws out the statement, the other one is a do-over.
to a certain extent. Takes it back to that level, says we withdraw his guilty plea, we just start over from scratch and just do it over from that stage. And the second one is saying we're throwing out his Miranda Goodchild motion hearing. If he wants to have a trial, he can have a trial.
What about with or without the statement?
Without the statement.
What about a good old Lochner hearing? You want that? On the ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, I went through that just basically because of wanted to cover myself on Mr. Kasinson's failure to object to that. I don't know what a Lochner hearing would do. I think that having Mr. Kasinson say he had strategic reasons or not, I think we're going to just approach this whole level and come back up the chain of situation again. I don't know if a Lochner hearing would accomplish it. I know I argued for a Lochner hearing at the trial level. I think maybe if the court feels that a Lochner hearing is necessary, finds him ineffective, then we're back to square one. And if it doesn't, we're going to appeal this whole thing up, and you'll see us again in a couple of years. I don't know what else to say. If there are no further questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Rosen, and thank you, Mr. Becker, for the lively argument we had this morning on an issue that's open law in the state. That ends our hearing on 02-0153 CR State versus Giles. And we will allow the Viroqua students, if they wish, to leave. And